If a player cleans his ball during play of a hole, except on the putting green, he shall incur a penalty of one stroke. That's a rule, Jerry.
But it's just a friendly game. Why do you always have to be such a stickler?
Because that's the way I was raised.
Welcome to Spirit of the Game, brought to you by the Colorado Golf Association. Here are your hosts, Ed Mate and Lewis Harry.
Well, on that note, welcome back. It's time for another edition of Spirit of the Game, my favorite time of the month when we get to talk rules of golf. This was such a great topic that we needed two parts to cover it. We are in the middle of a discussion with Greg Wythe, chairman of the CGA Rules of Golf Committee, talking about tragic rulings. And again, we all know there's no tragedy here, but in our little world of golf, we're calling it tragic ruling. So for those that didn't hear last month's episode, we were in the middle of talking about a situation that occurred at the Women's Open. And Greg, I can't remember the year, so maybe you can refresh our memories on that one. But it's Anna Nordqvist with a ball in a bunker in an extra hole aggregate playoff. And because it was a playoff, all the cameras on property were now being redeployed on two golf balls instead of 156 or whoever made the cut. And poor Anna was caught by those cameras ticking a grain of sand. And again, this was before 2019, when the rules of golf had been changed to address this very issue. And she was penalized, even though there's no way a naked eye most likely could have picked it up. But believe me, with the help of super zoomed technology, it definitely became a fact. So Greg, welcome back again.
Thank you. Well, this was the 2016 US Open, and it was a three-hole playoff. And on the second hole, Anna Nordqvist was in a bunker. And as she was preparing for the shot, she had her club close to the ball and was set to take it back. And when she took it back on her backswing, she didn't see anything, and she wouldn't have anyway, because she was standing right over the ball and the club would have blocked her view. But she made the shot, and then the person who had the close up on her ball in the bunker, and as you said, Ed, there's probably six cameras looking at this particular shot because they're the only two players on the course. They noticed that that a few grains of sand had been moved on her backswing. And, you know, on the replay, there was just this tiny furrow that was made as the club was taken back. And so that becomes, you know, a fact. You know, it's not open to interpretation whether she moved sand or not, because the cameraman was able to zoom in as if that ball was, you know, a foot in front of him. And you could see that she moved some sand when she made her shot. This was completely unintentional. So the rules of golf at that time were very specific. If you moved any sand in a bunker, and you could consider any evidence at all, including close-up video displays, and if in fact some sand was moved, there wasn't any wiggle room. It becomes a two-stroke penalty for improving your line of play. The USGA didn't know immediately what to do with that, so they waited a while before they told her. And it wasn't until the next hole that they told her that she was going to get a two-stroke penalty. And additionally, didn't tell her opponent that, you know, she was now leading by two rather than the tournament being tied. So that affected how Anna Nordqvist would have strategically played the holes from then on out, and also affected how I think it was Brittany Lincecum, played the remainder of the hole, because, you know, if she's all of a sudden up two with one hole to play, you know, she might not hit a driver on a hole. She may hit a hybrid or maybe even something less than that, because a bogey will probably win the tournament.
Yeah. And as I recall, Greg, a couple things to insert here. It was right in the middle of the play of the hole that Mark Newell walked over to Brent, and it was Brittany Lincecum, and informed her of the penalty. And obviously it was kind of, as I recall, maybe I'm not remembering this, there was a par five and there was a potential layup or go for it. So it was a pretty consequential decision she was about to make. And they decided, apparently smartly, that she should know that at that particular time. As you said, at that point, while it's not match play, effectively they were opponents at that point. The other thing I just thought of as we're talking through this, interestingly enough, in the Tour Championship, this very ruling reared its head with Sahith Theegala. And he had, unlike Anna Nordqvist, there didn't have 20 cameras on one golf ball. There was only one, and it wasn't a particularly good angle. And Sahith Theegala called the penalty on himself, or at least I shouldn't say that. Sahith Theegala made it known to the rules committee that he might have, that he moved sand and was operating, I think, under the belief there was going to be a no harm, no foul there. So I just think it was interesting that we're talking about this. So maybe that was the way the computer gods wanted us to lose the other half, as we now have the ability to work in that situation to this discussion.
I'll talk a little bit more about Sahith in a moment, but let's work through this one. So anyway, she gets a two-stroke penalty, and that's essentially, that's the end of the playoff. The rules have since changed. In today's rules, when the committee is deciding questions of fact and making a ruling, the use of video evidence is now limited to what a player could have seen with the naked eye. And not just the player, but, you know, any other player or any bystanders. If they could have seen it with the naked eye, then there's going to be a breach. But if the facts that are shown on the video couldn't have been reasonably seen with the naked eye, the video evidence will be disregarded, even if it suggests that there's a breach of the rules. In Anna Nordqvist's case, there is no way in the world anyone could have seen this without that telephoto lens zeroed in on the ball in the way that it was. And so they would have disregarded the video evidence, even though it existed. It didn't pass the test of could it have been seen with the naked eye.
So again, to be clear on that, if the same thing happened today, Anna Nordqvist would not have been penalized, and I believe, and I think you'd agree, that's a good change.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think we need to look at the intent of the rule is we don't want people to improve their lives in bunkers. And generally, if you remove sand from behind the ball, that gives you, you know, a better approach into the ball when you're making that explosion shot. So
I like the word, your use of the word intent of the rule. And so playing off of that intent, let's fast forward to a week ago at the Tour Championships, Sahith Theegala, no intention to touch the sand, but he was in a fairway bunker, much like Anna Nordqvist, and thought he brushed, was pretty convinced that he had brushed some sand. And in most cases, as I think Kevin Kisner said, the hitter knows, which I thought was an interesting term. The hitter knows best. And what unfolded was really interesting to me. And my interpretation, and Greg, I'd be interested if you read about it or heard about it the way I did. So Theegala takes it to his the person he's paired with. I always lose myself in what we call that anymore. And do you remember who that was? Whoever he was playing with agreed that you should bring it to the attention of a rules committee member, but they also seemed to agree, based on what I heard, that it was going to be a no harm, no foul, that you didn't intend to do it. So sure, bring it up. It'll be no problem. So he did. And they, this case, the video evidence was not so clear. And it was really on the gala to make the call. The cameras didn't confirm or rule out anything. So now he's got to do the right thing. And it, he's gotten a lot of, appropriately, he's gotten a lot of compliments and praise for being a good, you know, doing the right thing, operating with integrity. And again, I think we should just leave it there then, rather than think that he actually wasn't, he was just trying to cover his rear end. But the reality is, it was really important that he brought it to the attention of the committee, because if it came up and he hadn't raised the issue and it's later discovered, he would have gotten in probably in deeper trouble. So maybe you can clean up your thoughts on the Thigala's and how that compares and contrasts to Anna Nordquist.
Well, you know, he was pretty sure that he had moved some sand. And there's another element about the naked eye rule that kind of reads the other way. And in so many words, it says, even where video evidence would be disregarded under the naked eye rule, a violation of the rules can still be found if the player was aware of the facts establishing, you know, a breach. And, you know, he was aware of it. And so because he was aware of it, even though the video evidence was somewhat inconclusive, then there's a breach of the rules. I think one of the things that's neat about this is it's self-reported. And, you know, later in the day, when someone told him that that could potentially cost him a lot of money, he said, well, at least I can sleep tonight. And, you know, I like that. And yeah, ultimately that cost him close to $3 million. So, you know, when players self-report the rules, it just reaffirms what most of us know, is that golf is a game of integrity.
Well, and the golfing gods seem to be paying attention, if you believe in that sort of thing, because he rattled off a whole bunch of birdies after that. So maybe that was the way of forces bigger than ourselves saying, I'm gonna reward you. Putts are gonna break your way for the next few holes. So, okay, perfect segue, and you can tee this one up. I think I'm always finding segues where they, whether they exist or not, I find segues. So the one I see here is self-reporting. Now we're gonna talk about Tiger Woods 2013 Augusta. This was not a self-reported error, and I'm not suggesting that Tiger was doing anything intentional. Or because I don't think he was, but why don't you tee this one up?
This was in 2013. It was on the 15th hole of Augusta. And there's a creek in front of the green. And this is a yellow penalty area. And there's different rules that we use when taking relief under a yellow penalty area. And so, you know, he hit a shot that was as good a golf shot as you can possibly hit. And unfortunately, it hit the flagstick. It bounced back off to the left and then went into the creek. So this ball crossed this yellow line three different times, once on the fairway side, once on the green side, then it hit the flagstick and bounced into the water, so it crossed the yellow line off to the left of the green. You know, I think Tiger just misapplied the rules. I don't think he was doing anything nefarious here. His relief options, you know, he can either take stroke and distance, which is, you know, he'd drop a ball back then, you know, on the spot where he had made the stroke. And that was clearly visible because there was a divot hole there. And then he could go back on the line, and back on the line relief on a, for a yellow penalty area, it's where the ball last crossed the yellow line, which is off to the left of the green. And so to apply the rule correctly, he would have to go back across the water, keeping the flagstick in that point where it last crossed the yellow line in line, and then take a drop there. But there's a grandstand there, and there's really no place to take a drop. So, you know, we don't have lateral relief, you know, per se, in, you know, like we do with a red penalty area. You know, the lateral relief comes where it last crossed the yellow line. And so from that, that's his reference point. So he could take lateral relief there or back on the line, neither of which work. So where he messed up is he was thinking that where the ball crossed the yellow line to begin with, that he could go backwards from that and keep the flag stick at that point in line and then drop a little bit further. And so, you know, his whole point was, well, if I take it back 6 or 7 feet, I won't hit the flag stick. And so that's what he did. So he's dropped in a go ahead.
Yeah. No, you did perfectly. I didn't mean to interrupt, but the way you described it, I think is a better way of describing it. Cause I agree with you that he was just confusing options. And I think if he had simply thought I am going back on a line, it was the wrong line. He was going back on the line where it first crossed and even second crossed. He wasn't going back where it third crossed. So interestingly enough, if that ball had caromed directly back on that same line, he would have been just fine. But because it angled off at a 45 degree angle, that's what created the rub. So there was clearly no ill intent here. But as you said, he was just blending options. So what he should have been doing, if he wanted to stay at that same angle, he should have been operating under stroke and distance. And that would have required him to drop immediately on the spot, pretty much within inches. Instead, he was quite a bit more than that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He'd have to drop, you know, right where that divot hole was and then play on from there.
Well, so, what really makes it interesting is what happened next. And this all comes to light through the after round postmortems and interviews and all the back and forth that players have with media. So through those conversations, it became known to Tiger and to the media, frankly, that he had dropped in the wrong place, and there was damning. He admitted as much. He said it. It wasn't even if the video evidence wasn't even brought into the, which it would have shown he had indeed dropped in the wrong place. He admitted it. So now we know he has played from a wrong place. That is now a fact. And now the committee, and again, one of the challenges for me anyway, is remembering what rules were in place at the time versus the rules of today. But now the committee has to deal with this. And let's be honest, I don't care what anybody says. There's no rules official and no committee that is immune to fame and impact and media. And let's admit, Tiger Woods is a bigger name than this pick, I don't know, Dan Pohl. I don't know why that name came to me. Nobody even knows who that is except you and me, Greg. So, well, maybe you can help me remember how the committee was able to not disqualify Tiger, because by now he's turned in that scorecard. It's been turned in. There's a missing two-stroke penalty on his card. We talked about this in the previous episode with Lexi Thompson. And I don't know timing-wise, I think we're in the same relative time where I'm losing myself here. Remind me what the committee did and how we got to, because ultimately Tiger had a two-stroke penalty, but he was allowed to continue playing in the tournament. He was not disqualified.
Well, I'm not on the Augusta National Rules Committee and clearly was not privy to their discussion. I do know that a fellow named David Eager brought it to their attention later in that evening. They were concerned about it, and you know, they spent quite a bit of time trying to sort out exactly what had happened. And their ultimate decision was that Tiger would be assessed a two-stroke penalty and not a disqualification. So like you, I mean, I agree that tournaments like the Masters want to keep their best players in it. And they gave a very lengthy press conference the next morning and pretty much just said, here's what we're doing. Here's why we're doing. And, you know, the committee has some latitude on what they can do. And I think the Masters committee used every bit of the discretion that they were allowed to do and allowed him to continue the tournament.
So let's spend just one more minute on that, on the committee. We always say the committee's with a capital C. And to make sure that we're also not leaving our listeners more confused, and we are educating, which is part of the goal of Spirit of the Game, and you do a lot of rule seminars or a very good teacher of the rules, how would you summarize how much power the committee has? So if that happened today, well, let's not even use that example. Let's just sort of keep it more generic. Can the committee waive a rule of golf? That's a question that comes up. Can the committee just say, you know what, we know you did it, but we're not, you know what, we like you, or whatever reason, for whatever reason they want, they can just unilaterally waive a rule. Can they do that?
Now, the rule specifically address that the committee can't waive penalties or change penalties or waive rules of golf. That said, like if you take it to the club level, at the club championship, the committee is probably the head pro who may or may not have a lot of experience with the rules. And ultimately, he needs to make a timely decision. And sometimes they make incorrect decisions. And there's, you know, a saying that, you know, when the committee makes a decision, even when they're wrong, they're right. So you have to have, you know, timely decisions. And, you know, that happens at, you know, tournaments, you know, not professional tournaments and certainly not tournaments of consequence, but at the club level, you're going to see that happen a lot. But the committee can't knowingly and deliberately change or modify rules or penalties. They're pretty much, they're stuck with it. And the best minds in the world are on the rules committee at Augusta National.
Yep. I had a recent call from a club, and it was an unfortunate disqualification scenario involving a player. I'm trying to remember the exact situation, but it had to do with putting something on the face of a club, and that was completely innocent. It was some type of indication, you know, that you put on them for fitting, where you have a little sticker. It had absolutely no bearing on outcome. It was purely just an oversight. And unfortunately, don't mess with the club face. That was brought to the attention of the committee. And the question was, can we just overlook that? And the answer is no. That player was disqualified, as much as it seemed reasonable to say, you know what, no harm, no foul. They couldn't waive a rule of golf. So pretty important principle in the rules. Let's move on. Next item on our tragic rules list. We again teased this last time. This is 2016. So we're still prior to the modernization of 2019. And this involved Dustin Johnson, once again, our friend, Oakmont Country Club, US Open, fifth green, final day. Interestingly enough, his walking official is Mark Newell, who is the chair at the time of the USGA Rules of Golf Committee. So here's Mark Newell, who is not only involved with the modernization of the rules, he's the author of the new rules. And in the book at this time, albeit a draft, was a change to this very rule. So what happened was Dustin was in the process of playing a stroke on the lightning fast Oakmont greens. And as he was taking his practice swings, looking at making the final, moving the blade behind the ball moved. And Dustin backed away, called Mark Newell over, asked Mark Newell, what do I do? Mark Newell asked a clarifying question, which was probably, did you cause it to move? Knowing Mark, I'm sure he was very precise in asking that. He didn't say, did you address it? He said, did you cause it to move? And he answered no. So Mark Newell made the decision that any good referee would in that situation and says, well, in that case, play it from its new position. Again, this is before the modernization, so the rule has changed. So Dustin goes on and proceeds with his round. Well, after this happened, the USGA has a dedicated staff person who does nothing more than watch replay, watch live coverage, and make sure there's nothing that needs to be addressed. So a call in or any something that comes up, they're out ahead of it. So they looked at it a little more carefully under a microscope with the benefit of replay and, again, telephoto technology. And they decided that, you know what, Dustin's activity, his movements, his were very close to that ball. And we don't think the ball's movement was coincidental. It was definitely attributable to Dustin Johnson's proximity. So, not wanting to make a final decision, they then approached Dustin, I believe it was on the 12th hole, and our very own Thomas Pagel, who used to be on the CJ staff, was there along with Jeff Hall with the unenviable task of informing Dustin Johnson that he might have a penalty. Not that he would, but that he might. So that led to a very awkward situation for everybody, for Dustin Johnson, for the people competing, and for the viewers, because we didn't know the status of the tournament. Was there a penalty or was there not a penalty? And they weren't going to adjudicate that until the very end of the round. They wanted to give Dustin Johnson and the full opportunity to review the film. So we operated in this weird purgatory where nobody knew who was really leading the open because we were going to apply the penalty there or not. So thankfully for everybody, Dustin Johnson took matters in his own hands, played so well over the finishing holes that he won by enough strokes, including one of the most incredible five iron approaches to the 18th green that made it a non-issue because he won by, I believe, two, maybe even three. So the decision to apply a penalty stroke proved to be of no consequence. So the USGA dodged a major bullet. So that's what happened. And the good news is this is no longer a problem because the modernization now says if you mark and lift your ball on the putting green and you replace it and the ball subsequently moves for any reason whatsoever, you're going to replace it. If you kick it with your foot, put it back, no penalty. If you toe it with your putter, put it back, no penalty. If the wind blows it, put it back, no penalty. So the good news is once you mark and lift the ball on the putting green, you are pretty much on a safe place. What a great change. And again, it's ironic to me that this rule was already written, already in the books. And I can tell you this because I was on the committee when this happened. A lot of people assumed that this situation is what caused the committee to react. No, this was already in the books. So I said a lot there. Love to get your remembrances on that one.
Well, I think it was really awkward that he was initially told there was no penalty, and then he was told that there might be a penalty, and then the USGA reviewed this for six holes. That's a long time to review it. That's, you know, well over an hour. And then they told him that there was a penalty. This didn't affect just him. It affected the whole field that was still in contention to win the tournament. I think it's very fortunate that ultimately it was inconsequential because he won by three strokes. So, you know, when in talking to Thomas Pagel and to Mike Davis about this, they said in so many words that, you know, during that lengthy review that they saw the evidence, and that they had to act on it. And I, based on the rules that were in place at that time, I'll agree with that. I just think that you can do that in a timely fashion. It shouldn't take six holes to figure this out.
Well, and that so really, the, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, administering the rules in real time, especially, you know, under the lights of, you know, a worldwide audience isn't easy at all, but it's not that hard. You know, you need a review that video as quickly as you can. Have a couple people and see if there's, make a decision, see if there's consensus on what they saw, and then pass that information to all the players.
Well, and I think it warrants just a little more discussion on the uniqueness of golf and the timing and the finality of decision making. And we talked about this at the outset of this chat about Roberto DiVincenzo and scoring. But to me, what's particularly interesting in this instance, you got it right the first time. Why did they feel the need? And again, everything we've said in this podcast kind of one way or another informs all of it. The concern over somebody calling in after the tournaments and raising it. So wanting to be proactive and get ahead of it. The concern of technology and its ability to shine the light brightly on something that reveals facts that you couldn't otherwise see. All of it was sort of baked into this, but really with the benefit of hindsight, player asked for a ruling. A very qualified official gave him a very prompt decision. And that should have been the end of it. But no, the USGA kind of outsmarted themselves and said, we're worried here. What if somebody calls? And what if somebody complains? And what if we have to look at it? And instead of just saying, you know what? A decision was made. It was made based on the evidence at the time and just put an end to it. But instead, I think the biggest mistake they made was reopening the case. They should have left the case closed. Again, benefit of hindsight. I think that would have much better. Again, good news is now that same thing happens. Dustin Johnson calls Mark Newell over and he just says, put it back. Doesn't matter what caused it to move. So what a good change. But again, where I was going here is unlike basketball, football, where you see these instantaneous decisions that referees make all the time. And of course, even they are now being second guessed by instant replay and splitting hairs. We saw one just last night. Here's another reason why we benefited from this delay in the losing the podcast is we got to see the Kansas City Chiefs beat the Baltimore Ravens on a last second play where the toe of a player was on the line. So the decision made in real time was touchdown and Baltimore going for two to win the game. Instead, we looked at it. He was out by literally a millimeter. So anyway, to me, it's just fascinating to look at golf because we do generally have more time to make decisions than in other sports.
Indeed.
That was a lot. I just rambled off a whole bunch and you just said, indeed. Wait, come on, give me more than indeed.
I think one of the reasons that I enjoy working with the rules of golf is it's not like I have to immediately react and give a ruling when someone calls me over. And there are some very complicated rulings where you may have, five or six rules involved, some of which supersede the other. And, it's complex and you sort of have to draw a little chart about what happened, when, who knew it and why. And in golf, I have the luxury of calling for a second opinion and have someone, over the air, either concur or tell me that we need to think about this. Now, that doesn't mean we can think about it for six holes. It means that we can come to the right decision. And usually with, two or three rules officials, we quickly come to the exact rule and we come to a consensus almost immediately. The other thing in golf that I like is that there's times when you can't, when you're just not sure and no one is absolutely sure. So we've got a rule that says, well, the player can play two balls into the hole. And at the end of the round, we can take a look and review those rules and tell them which ball counts. There's going to be one that the player wants to count. And there's going to be one that's going to be the original ball. And so, we have that option that you don't have in most professional sports where the officiating pretty much is, reacting and, calling a foul or someone out of bounds or something like that. And Some things in football aren't reviewable, even though it's clear what happened. So, but in golf, you know, we've got that playing two balls up our sleeves if we have to use it. So golf is very statutory. Attorneys and police officers either make really good rules officials or they make horrible rules officials. But, you know, because it's statutory, I think they understand the black and white of the rules that that we have in place. The rules of golf are much simpler than the rules of football or the rules of baseball. I mean, I defy anyone who's listening to this to tell me all the ways that a pitcher can balk. We only have 25 rules. And in baseball, man, it's a big book and the language is very complex and the situations are very unusual.
Yeah, that's interesting. One more comment on timing. I had a fun opportunity at the BMW Championship last month to walk the back nine with Pete Liss, who is a former CGA tournament director, now a rules official on the PGA Tour, and Mike Peterson, who is a former intern for the PGA section, Colorado PGA section. I got to work with both of these great young guys that are not quite as young as they were when I first met them. And they're both rules officials on the PGA Tour. And I asked both of them, we're sitting on the 16th green, and I said, so how much pressure are you under the bright lights of the PGA Tour to make rulings quickly and knowing you have TV windows to hit? We don't want to send people over to Peacock or to another channel. And they both admitted it's apparent. They definitely need to move quickly. So Pete mentioned that in the example we were kind of chatting about was behind 16 at Castle Pines, where the whole location was such and the grandstands were constructed in a way where there was a few places where finding a nearest point of relief that was not closer to the hole was going to be a bit of a challenge. And I asked, you know, and Pete said to be proactive, and for the very reason you said, I will put balls in different places and kind of know in advance where we're going, so I don't sit there and take TV time or just delay the field by measuring and getting out of, you know, pacing something off. I want to know. But there's no doubt that when you're on that stage, and they generally don't allow players to play two balls, although they could, they have to make those rulings fairly quickly. But I like where you ended that comment on that, because I always say the rules of golf are infinitely more complicated than baseball and football because we play on a playing field that has a lot more variability, that a defined court is much simpler to deal with. But I think that may be not altogether true for the reason you stated, that the other sports have a lot of nuance to them. And frankly, when there's only one ball in play, some ways that makes it even more you're more keenly focused on splitting hairs.
So moving on, what do we have next?
Well, what we have next is we're going to wrap this up. We have a lot of here's the thing, Greg. If I can hear it, I don't know if can you hear that? That is like a standing ovation for us. I think I heard that, and it's just that was so good that we're gonna need an encore. We're gonna do this again. We're doing it by Zoom, so hopefully the sound quality is reasonably good. But it was a heck of a lot smarter for you to sit in your living room or your home office than it was for you to drive from Fort Collins. So this has been as much fun, if not more, than I expected. And I think we just in preparing for this, there's a lot more to cover. We could go on and on. And again, I really appreciate your taking the time and the work you do behind the scenes. Unless you play CGA tournaments, USGA qualifiers, NCAA, you may not know Greg Wythe, but if you do, you know him because he's one of the stalwarts. So thank you for coming on and sharing your experiences and your expertise.
I enjoyed it. This has been a lot of fun.
Okay, that's a wrap for this month. Maybe next month Greg will be back for part 4 or whatever part we're on. Thanks, Greg.
You're welcome.